You're listening to The Real Short Box, a comic book podcast made for geeks by geeks.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in and listening to The Real Short Box. My name is Donald, and I am here with a very special guest. We are here with writer, podcaster, and script consultant Howard Kasner. Thank you for joining us, Howard.
Hi, how's it going?
Oh, it's going just wonderfully. Thank you. It's a wonderful day out today here in sunny LA. Can't complain at all.
Well, I'm sure if we think about it long enough, we'll come up with something.
Yeah. When fire season hits again, I'm sure there'll be plenty of complaints I'll have to throw out there. But for now, I just keep knocking on wood in hopes that that doesn't happen. But we'll see. Today, though, we are talking about independent comic book films. So basically, comic book movies that were created from independent comic book companies, comic book companies such as like Dark Horse, for instance, or Comico, or, you know, Eclipse, Pacific Comics, anything like that, basically, that's not the big two, DC or Marvel, essentially just saying Disney or Warner Brothers. And how these kind of a little bit about how they came to be in a way, but just primarily discussing the story, the brief story of the film that we love and why we love it. So I'm going to go ahead and throw the ball into your court, Howard, and have you start for us with your number, I guess, whatever. If you want to go by a numbering system, your number five, or if you just want to throw one out there, go for it.
Well, I'll start with number five. I do have them in order.
Okay.
And this is probably the most traditional one on my list, and that is Men in Black, which was turned into a 1997 American science fiction comedy film. And it's about a secret government organization that hides and protects all the aliens that are actually really living among us, and keeps them under control and polices them. It revolves around two of these agents. Tommy Lee Jones plays the one that's been there for the longest time. I believe he is Jay, isn't he? And yeah. Will Smith. Yes, and Will Smith, who is a policeman and is out one night and happens upon one of these aliens and chases him, so impresses Tommy Lee Jones that he is recruited into the Men in Black and takes the name K. And basically, they're hunting down an alien who has come to Earth to find a power source that can
Agent K was Tommy Lee Jones. And I can't remember what they called.
Then Will Smith was Jay.
Was he Jay? Okay.
Was Jay.
That makes sense.
Right. And they're hunting down this alien who's come to Earth to find a powerful energy source that can destroy the world. I thought it was just incredibly clever when I saw it. I didn't know exactly what to expect. I did not expect it to be so witty, so clever, so smart, so much fun. Constantly had me going. I was constantly on the edge of my seat. Has some wonderful acting, but just a marvelous, marvelous screenplay. And great special effects and great makeup. And it won the Oscar for makeup that year.
That was directed by Soderbergh, right?
No, close. Barry Sonnenfeld.
Sonnenfeld. Okay, there we go. Yeah, I always get those confused. Some of them, man, like Cronenberg, for example, I always get him confused with the other guy that did the Twin Peaks thing.
David Lynch.
Yeah, David Lynch. So I always get Cronenberg and Lynch confused too, like all the time. It's just certain directors. I'm like, it's just old hat for me to confuse them.
I'm more that way with actors.
So basically, like Men in Black, that was originally a Malibu Comics comic book series. Malibu Comics was eventually, they were acquired by Marvel/Disney, but it was pre-Disney, so it was Marvel at the time. And basically what happened was is Marvel took all of these properties. They were acquiring them to get the rights to their printing because they had top of the line, like the best in the industry, printing capabilities. So Marvel wanted that technology, so they purchased them primarily for that. But they also found this multitude of characters that they could use. Unfortunately, since it's each character is independently owned by the creator, because it's a creatively, you know, very independent company that allows their creators to keep full rights to the characters, unfortunately, they would have to pay a large percentage of whatever they make per sale of said characters in order to produce these characters in Marvel, you know, the Mary Marvel manner. So that hasn't happened. That's why we don't see any new, like, Men in Black comics. That's why we don't see any new Prime or Hard Case or any of these other characters that were created through Malibu Comics. And it's really sad. It's a really sad story. But we still have Men in Black as a film property because it's independent of that. And it's done extremely well to the point where they've branched off and tried to do another type of kind of almost a subsect branch of Men in Black with Thor and, the Valkyrie lady. So
I don't know why they don't do a television series out of it.
Yeah, me neither.
Perfect.
It would be great. Yeah, it would be a great series. Definitely like HBO or something, you know, HBO Max or even Netflix would be great to pick something up like that. Amazon Prime, you know, somebody should pick that up. I'm going to go with one real quick. I'm from like 94 to 99 is what I call the golden age of indie comic films. So we've seen a multitude of films. And in fact, I think every single property I'm going to be talking about fell within that timeline from 1994 to 1999. And this one's on the tail end. This is the 1999 film Mystery Men, directed by Kinka Usher and was written by Neil Cuthbert. It was loosely based on Bob Burden's Flaming Carrot comics. Now, Flaming Carrot comics had the characters of Mystery Men appear in there. They're ridiculous characters like Mr. Furious, who's basically Ben Stiller, and he can get really angry. That's his power. Hank Azaria plays the Blue Raja, who's like a master of cutlery, so he can throw forks and knives and spoons really fast and far, and he's got pinpoint accuracy. We have William H. Macy, who plays the shoveler. God gave him a gift. He can shovel well. That's even in the script. Janine Garofalo plays the daughter of the bowler. She's the bowler, and she uses the severed head of her father that's now a skull encased in a bowling ball that she uses and can, like, use it to target people and stuff and knock people out. Then we have Paul Rubens as the spleen, the master of passing gas. He can knock you down with, like, just a whiff or a blow. And then a couple other lesser-known characters. But we have a great cast here, in other words, is what I'm trying to say. This is an amazing cast.
Well, it's interesting because, if I remember right, it's been a while since I've seen the film. These are sort of the superheroes that nobody else wants. Yeah. Sort of the superheroes that the Avengers would not accept into their myth because they're played also by not top tier actors, but second level actors. And so casting matches the way the characters are treated.
Yeah. A lot of people from like, from television and stuff, or that hasn't done much in a while.
They're not really leading characters, they don't play leading roles generally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jeffrey Rush is in this, but this is like huge breakout for Jeffrey Rush. And he plays the main villain, Casanova Frankenstein, who kills Greg Kinnear's character. And this is how the film starts, because Greg Kinnear, I believe, played Captain Amazing or something like that. And Casanova Frankenstein finds a way to kill him. And basically, Greg Kinnear is the ultimate hero. He was Superman. There was no need for any other hero because there was him. And he always found these mystery men to be ridiculous, because why would you ever need them? You know, go find a cat in a tree. Greg Kinnear, you know, Captain Amazing's here to save the day. You don't need these guys for anything else. So when he dies in the film, it leads to the formation of this mystery men, this ragtag group of D-level superheroes that form together to try to defeat Casanova Frankenstein and save the world. And it's super fun. It's a super fun, like, ridiculous film. If you just love ridiculous superheroes doing really dumb things, and if you want a really good time, like, really, really rewatchable for me. I love this film. I'll break it out every so often and watch it. It's something that I very much enjoy, and it has a really good lesson to it as well. Like, all these characters have their comeuppance, so to speak. They all have their time in the sun to shine. And that's what I love about this film. It's just really good. It's a really good story. And my hat's off to Bob Burden for even creating these characters to begin with, because they are ridiculous. Let's go ahead with your number four.
Well, my number four is called We Are the Best. It's a Swedish film. It was made in 2013. The writer and director is Lucas Moodysson. And he adapted the movie from the graphic novel that's called Never Good Night, which is written by his wife, Coco Moodysson. However, the film as a whole, I understand, was heavily improvised by all the actors in it. It revolves around three 13-year-old girls. It starts out with two of them, best friends, and they love punk music. But punk music is out of date.
Mm-hmm.
So they're teased by the other boys, especially one that is a rock band at their school. So they decide to get back at the boys who are in the rock band by starting a punk rock band. They recruit another one of their classmates, a rather shy girl. She's overtly Christian, but she knows how to play guitar. So they start trying to become this punk rock band, and it follows their relationships. They're trying to find, you know, their first steps at finding love or friendship. They have problems and sometimes break up and get back together again. It basically ends when their school, the head of the music department, takes both bands, the rock band and the punk band, to what is it called? It's some sort of festival, a youth festival.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, when the girls play their punk rock, the audience sort of jeers them. They make fun of them, and then it's in a place called Vastris. So one of them just automatically changes the lyrics of their song, which was called Hate the Sport. It was an anti-sport. It's how all the, you know, nerdy kids are teased in sport and they hate going to sports. Changed it to Hate Vastras, which is the name of the school, mm-hmm. Name of the place. And it starts a riot. So basically they've succeeded in doing what every punk rock band lives to do. They start a riot.
That's awesome.
And it's just a very sweet film. It was one of my favorite films of the year. I've seen it a couple of times. It was highly, the critics loved it. It's one of those that had, that was really well received, by the critics. It didn't really play long, you know, it's a foreign film. It's in Swedish.
Yeah,
but it's almost impossible not to like it, because you just get involved with these girls' lives, and it's really a nice movie.
Now, if the film's good enough, I definitely, like, even if it's like subtitled and stuff, I'll give it a whirl. It's when it's a series and it's like, this is four seasons long, and I'm like, man, I don't know if I have it in me to read that much television, you know? So, like, But a movie, if it's got a good gimmick or a good shtick to it, I'll check it out for sure. So this one sounds like a good one to me.
Yeah, it's just very sweet. It grows on you. It came out of nowhere, and the critics loved it.
Now I'm going to talk about the earlier period of time when I was talking about that golden era for independent comic book movies. I'm going to talk about 1994 now, because I said from 94 to 99 was this kind of sweet spot. 94 kind of really, in a way, started a lot of it and showed that independent films like this, like comic book films, can make a shit ton of money. And I'm talking about a film that grossed over $351 million on an $18 to $23 million budget. I'm talking about 1994, Jim Carrey starring The Mask.
Oh, yes.
Now, this was a superhero comedy film, but it was dark. It was created by Mike Werb. It's actually written by Mike Werb is what I mean. It's loosely based on Mask comics published by Dark Horse. Stars Jim Carrey, of course, and he basically finds this mask. Basically, it's a mischievous troublemaker. It's Loki's mask, if I recall. The god Loki used this mask to create trouble. So Jim Carrey finds this in the water. And after being kind of Stanley Ipkiss, being like this schlub that no one really likes or wants to deal with or anything, he's an insecure, cartoon-loving bank clerk. He finds this mask in the water and puts it. When he puts it on, he feels compelled to put it on. And when he does at home, he turns into this green-skinned, lovingly quirky, homicidal creature called the Mask. Basically a living cartoon, like a Textera cartoon, if you think about it that way. He's got a zoot suit on. It's big, bright yellow. He's got green skin. And he indulges in a comical rampage throughout the city. He humiliates several of his tormentors, including his temperamental landlady and the mechanics, for example, that gave him a faulty car, takes care of them. And then it starts to get a little darker. And then he starts to, you know, straight up, like, to defend himself, murder people that are just, you know, they're bad guys, don't get me wrong. But the Mask is not above that. And in the comic book form, actually, it is extremely dark. In that there is a lot of murder, and the Mask is not a very nice man at all. And the stories in the comic book, the Mask finds its way to new hosts one by one until their lives are essentially ruined. And then the Mask will move on and find a new host and then go from there and help them and then ruin their life and then move to the next person. A very parasitic nature to this character, this Mask. But of course, if you think about it, if it came from somebody like Loki that's a troublemaker, then that's the perfect vessel for something like this. So it was extremely successful. It did not spawn a sequel, unfortunately, unless you count Son of the Mask with Jamie Kennedy, which most people do not, because it was a failure. It was an awful film. Came out in 2005. And they waited too long. When a film comes out in 94 and it's huge, it makes almost, you know, $350 million, you want to follow up with a sequel pretty quickly. Waiting 11 years is a bit too long for something like that. And especially if you're not having the original actor that created the character and made it so wonderful. So for me, the 94 film, The Mask, it's a great independent film that reminds us of that there are great independent stories out there that can be easily turned into screenplays and made into film.
I remember when seeing it that this really demonstrated Jim Carrey's acting ability. I mean, before this, I'd seen him in a TV movie where he was really, really good. And then he was on the television series In Living Color, where he was really great, but he was playing all these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then he started making movies, and he was trying not to just make stupid movies. So here's this movie that's perfect for him, because he can play the straight character and then play this wild and crazy guy. It's like it's something Robin Williams would do. So this really demonstrated that there was a lot more to Jim Carrey than people might have thought at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And this also was the first role for Cameron Diaz.
Right.
And she played the love interest in it. And she did a wonderful job. There's a lot to this film to love, and it does really display a lot of his talent for Jim Carrey. And it's he kind of started to skyrocket with Ace Ventura Pet Detective, but he really hit the ceiling and blew past it with this film, The Mask, to show his star power. And there was no looking back after this film, to be honest.
Well, right, this showed that he could do more than just play Dumb and Dumber and Ace Ventura.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. So what's your, I guess it'd be your number three?
My number three is Blue is the Warmest Color, which was a somewhat controversial 2013 French film. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of people in it whose names I'm going to incredibly mispronounce. It was directed by Abdellatif Kashish, and it starred Léa Seydoux and Adèle Exarchopoulos, whatever. And it was based on the graphic novel of the same name by Jewel March. It's basically a romance between a high school girl, she's about to graduate, who falls in love with a female artist who has blue hair. But their love affair is very intense. It's almost over the top. And ultimately, it just does not work out. So it traces the highs and the lows. The reason why it was controversial, it was directed and written by a white man. And there's some very intense sexual scenes between the two women in the film that probably were more fantasy, a male fantasy version of lesbians having sex. Mm-hmm. Because lesbians were saying, this really isn't the way we have sex. And they also go on for a very long time. But in his defense, if you've seen any of his other films, he has scenes that just go on forever. And you're both saying, oh, I hope this keeps on going at the same time. Please end the scene. It's really weird how that works. It's very long. It won a lot of awards. But it is somewhat controversial today from that perspective. It won Cannes, and unusual for Cannes, they not only gave it to the director, they gave it to the two lead actresses as well.
Wow. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. I didn't know a lot about this film, to be honest, but in fact, I didn't even know it was based off of a independent comic book or a graphic novel, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That's quite fascinating. There's been a few French films and stuff that they've done in the past that have been based off of independent type of comics and things like that, or just graphic novels or comics.
Yeah, I almost want to say that next to the U.S., it's France and Italy, and then Japan probably.
Yeah, well, I mean, like Tintin, Tintin's British French type story, and very popular over in the Europe High in Europe. They did that one. What was that? Oh boy, probably about 10 years ago, maybe 12.
That gave me a headache.
Yeah,
Steven Spielberg,
and what's his name? Lord of the Rings. Jesus. Oh. Peter Jackson.
Yeah,
the two of them together. They were supposed to do another one. Spielberg directed the first one, and then Jackson was supposed to do the second one, but the first one just didn't make enough money.
But they go back even farther in Europe sometimes, I think, because this isn't on my top five. It's an honorable mention. But mm-hmm. it's hard to mention an adaptation of an independent novel without mentioning Barbarella, which the early 60s with Fonda, and Dangerous Diabolique or something like that, which also comes from the early 60s. So, yes. And there's a series of Italian-French films that I want to see so badly, but you can't find them anywhere, called Asterix and Obelisk. I saw a preview when I was in Paris, France. It's supposed to be, it's one of these films that are series of films. They're supposed to be terrible, but they make a fortune.
Ah, okay.
And they have all the major stars in them, Catherine Deneuve, Gerard Depardieu, Roberto Benigni, as people like Julius Caesar and Mark Anthony and things like that. And they're satires of the days of Greece. Probably Greece, you know, that time.
Yeah, that film with what was it? John. What's his name? Grease, the film, Grease, the musical.
Oh, John Travolta?
Yeah, John Travolta. Thank you. Man, my memory's like gone. You hit a certain age, you just better write all these names down ahead of time. Right. Put it on your hand or something, for God's sakes. Right. I'm going to talk real briefly about two films back to back. First of all, because they came out the same year. 95 was an amazing year for cinema. And that's simply because it brought us two of the greatest independent comic book films of all times, both from the UK straight over to the US, the stories anyway, and then were adapted into films. We're talking about Lori Petty in the 1995 film Tank Girl, and we're talking about Sylvester Stallone in the 1995 film Judge Dredd. Now, Tank Girl has a pretty cool cast if you look at it. It's got Lori Petty. We also have Naomi Watts, who played her kind of a sidekick. Ice-T, who played a kangaroo-human hybrid. Yes, that happened. And Malcolm McDowell, who plays the evil bad guy genius that's trying to suck the world dry of its water. And that's how he controls the world, is by being in charge of the water and power companies and basically lording over the rights to water, which is becoming more and more prevalent now, more, you know, noteworthy, if you think about it, nowadays than it was back in 95. You know, it was a little bit ahead of its time in story. It's basically about Lori Petty in her tank that has a brain in it, of course, because why else would she be called Tank Girl if her tank was not somewhat sentient? And her and Naomi going up against Malcolm McDowell with Ice-T and the kangaroo guys, fighting them to take back the world and take back the rights to their water so they can live and not be under his rule, under his thumb. And it was a huge bomb. It only made it like $6 million out of a $25 million budget. There's a dance sequence in there. It's got a musical number, which I thought was fantastic. But it just didn't, I think at the time, like, everybody was a little bit too over the apocalyptic type films of the eras of Mad Max and Water Worlds and things like that. So Tank Girl just kind of fell by the wayside. It was directed by Rachel Talalay, who really had a lot of problems with the film itself. I think she didn't get final cut on it, so she was pretty upset about that. It had a soundtrack to it that was assembled by Courtney Love. It had a really cool makeup effects by Stan Winston. So there was a lot of things going for it. But overall, you know, it just didn't have the impact that they would have wanted. And it just it really just fell into obscurity. But it's a really good film. Howard, have you seen this?
I want to say I have, but it's been so long that I'm not sure that I could actually, you know, say that I have. I can't be absolute. Well, if I did see it, my memory is that I wasn't bored by it, but it was so long ago.
Right. Those things happen. For me, it was pretty memorable. I got to see it in the theater. I was excited. 95 was a good year for me. Followed it up with the adaptation of Judge Dredd. We've got Sylvester Stallone, Armada Sante, Diane Lane, Rob Schneider, and Max von Sydow. Perfect film. The only big problem people had, besides the fact that Judge Dredd there was a lot of comedic elements to this film, obviously with Rob Schneider being in it, but that didn't translate well to a lot of fans of the series because of the comic Judge Dredd, because originally Judge Dredd wasn't funny. The scenarios, the things that he did was kind of funny, but he wasn't funny himself. And he never took his helmet off, which he took it off repeatedly in this movie because, let's face it, it's Sylvester Stallone. He needs that face time. So that really kind of scorned their primary market there, which is the Judge Dredd fans, but also the mass appeal to the series, which it was so niche that it really didn't appeal to just Sylvester Stallone fans either. Plus, Sylvester Stallone's name and star power was kind of waning at that point as well. So it just didn't do very well in the box office. It did well enough that they redid it eventually and had it done a different style. Probably about, 12, 13 years back, we got a Dread film that was more to the liking of the fans. But again, didn't do too great in theaters. So this basically has to just do with you're a judge, jury, and executioner. You're one of the judges, and Judge Dredd is. But unfortunately, he gets set up, and he has to go on the run with Rob Schneider, his comedic sidekick, in order to prove his innocence and be helped by Judge Hershey, who's played by Diane Lane. All the while, he runs into Max von Sydow, who is a former judge, to try to help him in his fight against the evil Armada Sante, who is trying to create an army of judges by cloning them and having them do his bidding so he can control all of Mega City 1 and all of the Mega Cities that follow. So it's a really cool plot, a really cool story. Special effects now aren't what they once were. Still cool for a lot of different reasons, but you can definitely tell they're in front of a screen now in some of these shots, which is fine. But we get a really giant, like, puppet kind of a robot creature that's super cool near the middle slash end of the film. Armada Sante brings his ham and cheese up to 11, so we get that. It's a lot of fun. It's a great film, I think, and it's a perfect rewatchable 90s superhero film, Judge Dredd. And those are my two. I've got one more, so I'm going to go ahead and pass this over to you, Howard, if you want to make a comment about Judge Dredd. If not, if you want to jump into your choices, we'll go from there.
Well, I did see Judge Dredd. I guess I thought it was more just okay. One of the things you said was about Sylvester Stallone, and that was probably the problem I had with it. He was trying to make it into a vehicle for himself. He can be a good actor, but at some point, I think he gave up trying to be a good actor. And it's one of those films during that period where, you know, he was trying to make money and not be a good actor.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. I could definitely see that.
My next one is one that seems to be at the top of many people's choices for the best adaptation of an indie comic, and that is Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which came out in 2010. And it's sort of surprising because it was a flop. It didn't make near back the money it was spent on it, but it's based on a graphic novel series, Scott Pilgrim, by Brian Lee O'Malley. Stars Michael Cera as Scott Pilgrim. And he's supposed to, or he needs to win a competition in order to get a record deal. But at the same time, while he's engaging in the Battle of the Bands, he's fallen in love with this woman he meets, Ramona Flowers, and he has to battle her seven evil exes in order to win her. But things get complicated because he has his own faults, and he tends to cheat on his girlfriends, and he's a bit of a slacker, and he needs to gain more control of his life. It's very clever. It's structured like a video game and uses a lot of video game imagery of it as he moves up and conquers each X till he gets to the top. I thought it was incredibly clever. I thought it was incredibly smart. I love Kerry Culkin. He was one of my favorite supporting actors that year. He plays Scott Pilgrim's sort of landlord. Scott Pilgrim is sort of lives in his very, very small apartment. And it did flop, but today it has a very strong cult following.
Extremely strong. Edgar Wright created the screenplay, if I recall.
Right.
And directed it, and it was fantastically done. We even got to see a little bit more of Brandon Ralph and his acting ability. And I think even that's one more comic book film notch in the belt for Chris Evans as well, playing in this also. Chris Evans has done a lot of comic book films, more so than you would think. It's surprising. I think he's done like five or six now. And that's not counting, you know, like all the sequels to the Avengers and the Captain America films and such.
Right.
Well, let's go ahead to your next one. Your number two, then, I guess, since we
that was number two.
Oh, that was number two. Oh, geez. Okay. All right. Well, then you have one more. I'll go next, and then we'll finish off with yours, I guess. Great. Sound good?
Sounds okay. Good.
All right. I'm going to talk about the 1996 film starring Billy Zane. I'm talking about The Phantom. Now, on the poster, it says Slam Evil, and it has a picture of his fist with the skull of the Phantom glowing, and it's ridiculous, and I love every minute of it. I love this film for a lot of reasons. I love it because I got to buy Big Macs and sneak it into the theater and eat my Big Mac while I was watching the film, and did not even pay for the film because I snuck into the film, too. So we bought Big Macs. We snuck those into the film that we snuck into, which was like a perfect combination of getting away with evil deeds, so to speak. And unfortunately for them, Billy Zane was not there to stop us. So we finished the entire film, enjoyed every minute of it. It was also a vehicle starter for Catherine Zeta-Jones. This was her first film, actually. And it also had the forever beautiful Christy Swanson in there, the very talented James Remar, Patrick McGoohan was in there, and it was a screenplay by Jeffrey Bohm. Basically, it was inspired by three of the Phantom stories from the pulp stories back in the day. We're talking like the 20s and 30s. We're talking about the Singh Brotherhood, the Sky Band, and the Belt. They also added some supernatural elements and some new characters. It was shot 95/96, came out in 96, and came out with a thud. No one cared about this film, except for me and my friend Pat, of course, that we watched it and very much enjoyed it. It revolves around the fact that there's these three skulls that you could use to create an ultimate laser that you can use then to destroy anything. And by that, we have a character that wants to, of course, take over the world. And that would be Treat Williams' character. And he plays Xander Drax, a power-hungry businessman, a shady character with a reputation for dealing with criminals. One of the reporters that's involved is a reporter played by Christy Swanson, I believe. She's the news reporter's daughter, and she goes to prove that he's an evil man and falls in line with the Phantom, who they then eventually, of course, fall in love. He comes to the city to help her and comes out of the jungle where the Phantom usually fights. And it's a fish out of water type scenario with Billy Zane being in the city fighting evil. And kind of like an Indiana Jones, there's even pirates in here, guys. So, like, you can't lose with this story. It's a really solid film, a really solid adventure story. One that could be watched by kids and adults, both. It's really, I think it's very good. I think it's very fun. Critics were having trouble with this one because they weren't sure if it had the pulp adventure approach, if that was charming and authentic, or if it was vapid and dull, is what they said. I seem to go with the charming and authentic. It very much hit well with me, resonated well with me, and it's still one of my favorite superhero films of all time up to this day. So I couldn't recommend it enough.
I have to say, I have no idea if I've seen it, and I don't think I have. So
it's okay. We can't all be perfect. I would recommend it just so we could talk about it later. I think it's worth a watch, especially if you like Indiana Jones style films. What was it? The one that King Solomon's Mines and King Solomon and the Lost City of Gold. Those types of films. Alan Quartermain. Thank you. Those types of films, which is played, I think, by Richard Chamberlain, if I recall, played the lead in those. So that kind of camp fun mixed in with Indiana Jones kind of camp fun with good backdrops and set design and stuff like that. And Treat Williams again, much like the films I've talked about before, he takes his cheese level and turns it up to 11. So he plays a very good, interesting villain with a very good, interesting story. And I just recommend it. It's very good.
Great.
All right. So what's your last one, Howard?
Well, this is The Diary of a Teenage Girl, which was also very, very controversial when it came out. It's a 2015 American film, written and directed by Marielle Heller. And it's based on what's called a hybrid novel, So it is has both prose and drawings in telling its story. It's written by Phoebe Gluckner. It's about a, and this is why it's controversial, it's about a 15-year-old girl who starts becoming interested in sex, and she decides to start exploring it by having an affair with her mother's boyfriend.
Oof.
And it stars Christer, Bill Pauly plays the girl. Kristen Wiig plays her mother. And Alexander Skarsgård plays the boyfriend, and Christopher Maloney plays her stepfather. Yes, people really got, a lot of people got angry about a 15-year-old girl who is willingly having sex with this older man,
mm-hmm.
even to a certain degree instigated it, is to some degree in control of it until she isn't. And when she isn't, that's when things start really going wrong. But it's based on a true story. It's autobiographical. So it's, and it's written by women and directed by a woman. So it's not by sort of an exploitational film by a man. It's right. very realistic. It's very emotional. It's incredibly well acted. It's incredibly well written. It got great reviews. It made a small profit. But yeah, even the person who wrote it says, in looking back, she's sort of going, what was I thinking? Why did I do this? What was it about the situation where I actually did all these things? What was wrong with me? But she finds her way out of it mm-hmm. at the end, because she's a talented artist and wants to be a comic book artist. And she decides to start pursuing that. And that's how she finds her way out of the situation she's in.
Okay. That sounds very interesting, but also very risque, so to speak, I guess you could say. I don't know. It's a tough one.
I think it's more than risque. I mean, it's very honest. It's not raw. You know, it's not like Blue is the Warmest Color, where the sex is very next, not quite pornographic, but right next to it. It doesn't go that far, but it's very honest, let us say.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, well, I think that's gonna pretty much do us for this evening, or for this day, I guess, for the entire week. So thank you.
I would like to add one more thing if I could real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Some time ago, I was talking to a friend, we were talking about actually movies being adapted by comic books, but not superhero comic books, but the independent comic books. And he had a theory, and I thought it was very sound at the time, that comic books were going to become the new pulp novels of the 40s and 50s. In the 40s and 50s, when they made movies, one of the places they went to were pulp novels. These paperback crime novels that were adapted into film noirs and crime films and mysteries and other movies like that. They were one of the primary sources where people got movie ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought this was going to be true for comic book movies. I don't think it quite turned out that way, though at the same time, I don't think people realize just how many movies are actually based on indie comic books.
Yeah.
But I'm still not sure that it is like it was in the 40s, 50s, where it's where people are going to get their ideas. But I wish it was, because in the 2000 and 2010s, you know, movies stalled, and they were becoming less and less interesting, except for the Marvel Universe for some reason. You know, that was becoming more and more interesting. But movies were becoming less and less interesting. They were reboots, they were franchises, they were remakes. And I just wish that people would start going to these indie comics and start making a lot more movies out of them.
I agree. Universal does have a first look agreement with Dark Horse currently. And I will say Dark Horse is putting out some of the best horror content for books and stories that I've seen in quite some time. Another company, Boom, has just optioned the rights to a series called Something is Killing the Children. So that's going to be coming, I believe, to the small screen. So that's going to be made into a series. And there's a whole host of other types of independent books and stories that are currently being made, Lock and Key being one of them. That's on Netflix currently, along with The Umbrella Academy, which was a Dark Horse Comics book originally as well, by Gerard Way, I believe. So, and it's a very interesting time that we live in that I think we're going to get more and more of this as comic book sources seem to be flying off the shelves as far as and like out of the movie theaters with buku bucks. You know, it's just making a ton of money and they're looking for more and more content. So I think it's going to happen. I just wish like that some of the smaller and you're right, some of the smaller, more intimate stories can be told and they can go back to a little bit of that. And I think the pandemic kind of taught us one thing is that smaller sets and smaller casts with more intimate type of stories, it's not going to be a bad thing. So we might start seeing more of that. We'll see. Fingers crossed. But anything else to add before we go?
No, I think that's it.
All right. So thank you for being a guest on here, Howard. Very much appreciate it. Howard, you do a podcast real quick. What's the name of the podcast?
It is called Pop Art. It's where a guest chooses a movie from popular culture and I'll choose a film from the more art indie classic side of cinema that has a connection to it. And we talk about it. You were on an episode recently where we talked about Revenge of the Nerds and the silent film, the silent film, The Freshman.
Right.
I forgot what that was.
That's all right.
Today, I've been editing on the new one, which is Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and the John Ford film, Rio Grande. I also, if I can be more self-aggrandizement, I just hosted the Lambcast podcast on Mortal Kombat.
Ooh, nice. I look forward to listening to that one. And that's out now?
Yes, I've posted on my Facebook page. You can find it there or go to the Lambcast. I think it's lambcast.com. Or something like that. Okay. It was interesting because I knew nothing about Mortal Kombat. But he needed somebody to head it at the last moment. And I mean, the only one he knew who could actually record record it.
Yeah, that's funny. Like, and you're like, it's a game. Yeah. Well, thanks again, Howard. This was great. Very much appreciate it. Thanks for coming on. Yeah. And we appreciate it here at The Real Short Box.
Great. It was great being on.
Yeah, thank you. And we do these podcasts, these audio podcasts, usually every week, Thursday or Friday. We'll put those out on Spreaker, TuneIn, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google, iHeartRadio, all those and more. Plenty more. We have a YouTube Live that we do on Rumble Spoon Productions YouTube page. We do that every Monday, basically, or most Mondays, where we do a live podcast, video podcast, with a lot of fun content, stories, and things that you can vote for and stuff. So, we have a lot of great new things happening. We have a new sponsor. Splattered Frog Brewing is one of our new sponsors, and Half's Hot Sauce. So we have beer and hot sauce. Now all we need is like probably some pancakes to put some of the hot sauce on maybe and absorb some of the beer. I don't know. We'll figure it out. But thank you all for tuning in. If we don't see you out and about anytime soon, perhaps we will see you at the comic shop. Thank you for tuning in.
This has been The Real Short Box. We'll see you at the comic shop. Thanks for listening.